This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman. More people than ever before in the U.S. are being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders, or ASDs, but researchers don't know why. We'll be discussing autism, Asperger's, and other syndromes known as ASDs. My guests are Craig Erickson, a psychiatrist and assistant professor in the UC Department of Pediatrics and Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Janet Side, Family Outreach Associate with the Kelly O'Leary Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Children's. You can join our conversation. The number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Later this hour, we'll talk about the proper way to use CPR and an automated external defibrillator to save the life of someone experiencing sudden cardiac arrest. Again, right now, we're going to be talking about autism spectrum disorder. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 513-419-7100. Thank you both for being here this afternoon.
Thank you. Hey, good to be here.
Craig, let me start with you. It's always good to start a show like this with a definition. So define autism spectrum disorder.
Autism spectrum disorder is a form of neurodevelopmental disorder impacting three key areas. The first area is social skills and a degree of social skills impairment. So difficulty maintaining, building peer relationships and interacting in ways that would be characteristic of normal development. The second area of impairment is communication deficits and deficits in social communication. And it can also just be a lack of spoken language, delay in language development. And the third area of impairment that defines autism spectrum disorder is interfering repetitive behaviors. So fixation, routine adherence, need to do the same thing in certain ways. Sometimes it can be repetitive behaviors such as flapping, rocking, finger twirling, spinning. So it's really three areas: social deficits, communication deficits, and then interfering repetitive behaviors. Has to have an onset early in life, so they're early childhood onset disorders, and they're lifelong conditions.
What are the signs and symptoms? And again, I guess it depends on the age, but normally you're talking a very, very young age. But what should parents be looking for?
Really, I think important thing for parents to look for are things like eye contact, shared play, interest in interacting with others. We'll often ask parents, at an early age, how did you feel the child was connecting with you? Were they looking at you? Did they want to share play? Did they keep more to themselves? Another key early marker is language development. So not only delayed language, but some individuals with autism may develop language and then regress or lose speech. I think one real concerning marker for the potential for the development of autism is a child that's speaking and then stops talking. And that may impact 25 to 30 to 40% of children with autism, but that's very concerning. But it's really that early communication and then social engagement, things like modulating facial expression, smiling appropriately, being able to sort of have reciprocal give and take and like a patty cake play situation. Those sort of things, when they're lacking, are concerning, and parents should really bring that up to their pediatrician, primary care provider, or other professionals.
When you talk about eye contact, I think in some of the research that my producer put together for this, there was the idea, I think I'm going to remember this right, that looking at the eyes versus the mouth.
Yeah, in fact, we study that with an eye tracking machine where we're able to track in our research exactly what individuals are looking at. And it's been shown that as early as 6 months of life, that children that will go on to be diagnosed with autism have reduced eye gaze towards the eye region and look more at the nose or the mouth or away from the face.
Janet, you not only work with ASD patients at Children's, but you have a son with autism. Tell us about your experience.
So my son Andrew is 18 years old right now, and he was diagnosed when he was 3 years old. And at that time in Cincinnati, there really weren't the resources that we have right now. So we were really leading the way with trying to find all the different treatments and resources and things that would be able to help him.
What were the keys that caused you to seek out answers?
Andrew didn't have any language until he was about 3 years old. So we had a different trajectory than what Craig was talking about, where some children lose their language. For Andrew, he didn't have any language at all. And the other things that we noticed is he was not really responding to his name when he was being called, and he wasn't pointing at all.
How do you, you said, discuss these things with your pediatrician. How do you go about diagnosing this?
Well, I think there are a number of ways to do it. And the gold standard best diagnosis is still a clinical interview and evaluation by someone with expertise in the field, no matter where they come from, psychology, pediatrics, developmental pediatrics. I'm a child psychiatrist. But there are also a lot of new standardized diagnostic instruments that we can utilize. For instance, at Cincinnati Children's, we do a lot of what are called the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, or the ADOS, A-D-O-S. It's a structured interview with a child that really is rating these areas of communication, social skills, and repetitive behavior compared to children that don't have autism and do have autism to create norms. And that's a very objective assessment. It takes about 45 minutes to an hour, but it needs to be done by a professional with a lot of specific training.
And is this something that starts with an infant?
Yeah, I mean, we're saying well, that...
And I guess what I'm thinking about is how do you interview an infant?
You can interview, by 24 months of age, we can diagnose autism with, I would say, 90% certainty that a diagnosis at 2 years will still be a diagnosis at 18 years of age. Younger than 24 months, it's a little tricky. But really, I think we have confidence coming into clinic just based on a clinical interaction, even in a nonverbal child, because you're looking for things like eye gaze, nonverbal cueing, social interest, other aspects, like Janet mentioned, of pointing, that a child very early in life should point at an object, look at someone, and then look back at that object. It's called essentially shared gaze or shared attention. Those are things we can pick up on interview, really, even down to about the 12 to 18 month age range.
Janet, did you want to add anything to that?
No, it's just that things have really progressed over the years, and even the things that Craig is talking about now, our center has really improved upon all the different treatments and the diagnosis process than when my son was first in that process many years ago.
Is there some of the research, is there a group of children that are at higher than normal risk for ASDs?
Well, we know that if there's an older sibling with autism, that there's a 20% chance that a child born to those same parents will go on to be diagnosed with autism. So it is a highly genetic disorder, but yet the vast majority of the time we cannot find a genetic cause. It's truly puzzling. We've known for about 37 years that identical twin rates of autism, if one twin has it, there's a 70%+ chance the other one will. So there are a lot of genetic risk factors within families. But when we do state-of-the-art genetic testing, we really only can find known specific causes in maybe 20 or 30% of cases. Now, the technology just hasn't advanced to the level to really ferret out all of the genetic underpinnings. But we know there's a strong factors involved.
On the genetic question, we had an email from Jeremy in Cincinnati who says, I was wondering how much genetic research on the causes of ASD have been done. Specifically, has there been any research studying the Y chromosome and its relationship to ASD? I'm interested in this because many male relatives on my father's side of the family, including myself, have been diagnosed or show symptoms of Asperger's and other autism spectrum disorders.
That's a great question. One thing that's been consistent in autism research through the decades is that there's a male preponderance of the disorder at a rate of about 4-to-1, male to female. And it does have to do with the XY chromosome balance. Females have two X chromosomes, males have one. So if there's any genetic abnormality on the X chromosome, males are more vulnerable because they don't have the second X to compensate. So it's not actually a genetic abnormality on the Y chromosome as much as it's not having that second X. So we know that males are more vulnerable. In the X-linked disorders, I study something called Fragile X syndrome. It's a genetic cause of autism. It impacts males at a ratio of 2-to-1 because it's X-linked. It's a abnormality on the X chromosome, so males are twice as likely to be vulnerable because they don't have that other protective X. So that's clearly true. We do genetic research, biobanking of genetic samples to do further genetic analysis. And the best genetic testing today, we're at rates of 20 to 30% of really finding a known reason. And we really think about autism in the plural as autisms, in that we may discover hundreds of different contributing genetic factors, each one of which may only cover or be responsible for a very small percent of the cases.
Someone asked, what's the difference between autism and Asperger's and Rett's?
So in the last year, we have a new diagnostic manual that's gone to a unitary autism spectrum disorder diagnosis. Prior to that, there were five subgroups of sort of pervasive developmental disorders that were loosely termed autism spectrum disorders. Asperger's disorder traditionally referred to individuals that had normal language development, normal IQ, but had social deficits and interfering repetitive behavior. The vast majority of those with Asperger's would now be termed under the high-functioning autism sort of label in the current parlance. Rett's is a very rare genetic condition associated with significant developmental disability, microcephaly or small head growth, a lot of repetitive hand movements, high risk for seizures, and it primarily affects females because males with Rett's are thought to pass away in utero.
We are talking about autism spectrum disorders. If you have a question, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. My guests are Craig Erickson, a psychiatrist and assistant professor in the UC Department of Pediatrics and Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Janet Side, a family outreach associate with the Kelly O'Leary Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder at Children's. Again, 513-419-7100. Janet, tell me what you do at the center at Children's.
My official title is Family Outreach Associate. So what I do as a parent is provide that family experience to the clinicians so that they can really understand what the family will have to go through if their child is diagnosed with autism. So that really helps when they are providing recommendations for treatment or therapies for the families. Are those going to be practical for a family? Are those the family going to be able to achieve those therapies? The other thing that I do is I provide training for families and professionals. And I do that in a model that we have with a psychologist at our center. And I provide the family point of view, she provides the professional point of view, and the model really works. And we do the trainings on a number of different topics.
We know about your center. Grace posted on Facebook, and she wanted to know, are there any support groups for spouses of men with Asperger syndrome?
So that's a really good question. And there's an organization in town called Families with ASD that's done a lot of support for dads specifically. That's the only one that I know of right now, although there are support groups from the Autism Society of Greater Cincinnati. They have support groups for family members, and they also have support groups for individuals with autism.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, 513-419-7100. Patrick, you have a question? Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, my question was, in the intro to the show, it was repeated several times that the rate of diagnosis for autism seems to be getting higher and higher in recent years. How much of that can just be attributed to better diagnosis? I know Asperger's wasn't a term I'd ever heard 15 years ago.
I mean, that's a great question. I'd say for years, when I lectured, I would speak of just increasing awareness, doing a better job diagnosing. An old term called pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, that was essentially mild autism, wasn't diagnosed at all prior to 1980, and that was sort of half of what has made up autism spectrum disorders as a group. So in that sense, you could double the numbers just by sort of diagnosing a milder group. But as we look at the exponential change over time, I think it's really potentially a combination of both, that we see increase in, you know, potential actual incidence of cases, and then we're just diagnosing better. But if you look at the numbers, 1 in 88, it's many, many fold what we would have seen even 10 years ago. What we really have to do as researchers is figure out what factors are involved. Are they environmental factors? Are there factors such as older parental age? And there are other things that we really need to tease out and better understand. But I think there are multiple things going on, and I'm no longer simply saying that it's likely just better or more precise diagnostic work.
And Patrick, we appreciate your call. When you talk about research that I had, the environmental factors, talk about some of those environmental factors. We were talking about the air we breathe, the water we drink.
And it's really tricky because you don't want to scare people. And studies come out all the time that talk about things like obesity during pregnancy, or like I said, older age during pregnancy. And we don't know great perfect associations. The only really known association exposure-wise is something called valproic acid exposure, or mothers who may be taking a medication called Depakote for epilepsy or bipolar disorder during pregnancy have a greatly increased risk of having a child that develops autism. But that's a very small percentage of the cases. So we don't have it pinned down. People wonder about, you know, is it proximity to where you're living, or is it radioactivity, or is it something in the air, smog, particulate matter? We don't know, but we're trying to design studies to figure that out, both at a human level and in animal models of autism.
And we have Richard, who is on the phone from Delhi. Richard, go ahead.
Yes, I was reading a periodical over the summer about autism, and I read where certain people can actually outgrow this situation. They develop connections later on in life. Is there any proof of that?
I remain skeptical of the concept of outgrowing autism, but at the same time, I always counsel new diagnosis cases that individuals with autism develop and make gains and grow and progress, and you should never take that concept away. But the idea that it is a lifelong disorder, and if you truly have autism spectrum disorder as a child throughout life, there should be some degree of symptomatology, social impairment, communication impairment, what have you, that should persist. And so in those cases of sort of curing autism, or Jenny McCarthy would talk about diets or other things, or child no longer has autism, I really look at those in a skeptical way and wonder what the diagnosis was originally.
Janet.
And I could say as a parent that I can attest that my son has definitely made progress over time. But when he was 3 years old, he was diagnosed with the PDD-NOS that Craig spoke about before. And then when he was tested again in the transition stage, now as he goes to graduate from high school, he's still diagnosed with autism. But he did definitely make progress over time.
513-419-7100 if you have a question. And we have John on the line from Evendale. John, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. So my family's always worked under the assumption that my 8-year-old son has Asperger's. He meets, you know, any kind of symptom that we can find online or wherever that would say that you have Asperger's. I mean, he meets perfectly. However, he's never really gotten clinically diagnosed. We had a school psychologist in his first grade class try to come in, but by the time she got there, he was very set in his patterns, and his teacher had already gone out of her way to try to accommodate some of those patterns, so it never really was successfully diagnosed. So my question would be, what benefits would there be to getting him clinically diagnosed at this point in his life to outweigh the negatives of kind of the stigma or the negatives that the schools would kind of hang on him?
Janet, you want to take that?
So I think it's really important to have the diagnosis. And the reason why is he's still young and he could benefit from an individualized education plan or an IEP. And having the IEP allows a child to have certain accommodations and modifications in the school setting. And that could be really helpful for him to have that support. So they will not give you the IEP without the diagnosis. So that's really important. And then later on also, I think it's important for an individual to be able to advocate for themselves. So I think having the diagnosis, while not always revealing the diagnosis, is important to have for an individual so that they can then know what they need to ask for help for.
Craig, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a diagnosis in a lot of ways is power, and it unlocks a lot of resources at state levels, local levels, and it also helps focus both school and all of the providers an individual may see on the deficits associated with autism as a target of treatment. I think it really can help communication about what's going on, and it can help the interface between medical providers and school systems so people are on the same page.
Again, 513-419-7100. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a son that's going to be 19 in 2 weeks, and he was initially diagnosed from Children's Hospital with, like, mental retardation, but he just has problems with, like, if he went to a store and he gave $5, he wouldn't know how much change he's supposed to get back, so he has a problem with very simple math. And he is kind of reclusive and shy. And he's best friends with his sister, who is about 2 years younger than him. But I just wonder if he has a real mild case of autism.
Man, I think it's a great question, and we assess individuals at all ages and are really committed to ongoing care into adulthood. And I think, there's potential that milder cases of autism may not be picked up during the ages of youth and maybe potentially even more apparent into adulthood. But the questions I would, ask yourself and we would ask in clinic is, what are social skills like? And you have to control for the developmental delay. So if someone's 19 and has a developmental delay and is otherwise cognitively functioning as a 12, 14, 16-year-old, you would only expect social skills at that level. If social skills are much more delayed than that level, then I think the concern builds and you really should get a more sort of pointed and focused assessment, which we can provide at Cincinnati Children's.
513-419-7100. Janet, when we're talking about the treatments, I would assume you said your son is 18, was diagnosed when he was 3, and
yes.
Things are certainly different in that 15-year period.
For sure.
How have treatments changed, as you've seen, in that 15-year period?
Well, at Cincinnati Children's, we use something called an evidence-based practices. And so evidence-based practices means that it has research behind it. And so this is really very much an emerging field, if you want to think about that. And now that Andrew is turning 18 and he's going on to transition, there are just some things that haven't been invented yet. And so you could say that about the field in general and the treatments. When Andrew started, there were things that hadn't been invented yet. And now that we're at the point of transition, there are just some things that are still emerging and haven't been invented yet. So, I always say to parents, they have to look into everything as far as treatments are concerned. But really, your best treatments are the ones that have the research behind it.
And when we say treatments, what are we talking about?
So speech therapy, occupational therapy, social skills groups.
And these are all things that you can get through children.
And other places around the city.
There was something, again, in the research that I had where I was talking about medication.
Mm-hmm.
How does medication fit into this?
Well, we do a lot of medication-based research, and there's a lot of research to support treating associated symptoms and behaviors with autism, meaning not everybody has it, but some people do. There's a significant percentage of individuals with autism that may develop aggression and self-injurious behavior, or severe tantrums. Maybe you could call it a significant minority even. There are two FDA-approved medications, aripiprazole and risperidone, that effectively treat those associated behaviors. They're very well researched. We also end up treating things like anxiety and mood issues in the context of autism, ADHD in the context of autism, pretty effectively with medicines. Our research is really focusing on new treatments that may treat the core symptoms of autism, so core social and communication impairments. That's where nothing is approved medication-wise, and we're trying to really be on the cutting edge for new treatments in that area.
How important in this is early intervention?
Oh, early intervention is the key to this whole thing. I mean, as soon as you notice symptoms in your in your child, you definitely should seek help first with the family practitioner and then, down to Children's if it need be after that. But the earlier you could get the intervention, the more progress I have seen children make.
And this is one of those things that you might want to pass off that, maybe that's nothing important. If you're suspecting you need to talk, even if it turns out to be nothing, it's better to talk about it with a pediatrician than to ignore
Absolutely.
It.
And you know what? You don't need a diagnosis to treat the symptoms. So if your child is having trouble with emerging language, then go see the speech therapist. If they're having trouble with fine motor skills, then go see the occupational therapist. If they're having trouble socially, maybe you contact a psychologist. But just treat the symptoms.
Did you want to add anything?
I mean, early intervention is the key in early diagnosis, and that's in part why our research is really trying to focus even in infancy and early toddlerhood to look at these younger infant siblings that have this high risk of autism at a rate of 20%. What can we do at the earliest stages of life, even at 6 months, to intervene and provide early diagnosis? Because that's how we're going to make a difference. If you wait till you're 3, 4, 5, 6 years of age, you've really lost some golden windows of intervention.
Olivia called and wanted to know how would they suggest approaching an adult friend who shows signs of Asperger's but refuses to discuss getting checked?
That's a really tough question. I think, it becomes down to what may be impairing, right? Like if someone is has Asperger's, and due to that, the symptoms associated with that autism spectrum disorder, having trouble in the workplace, trouble with interactions, if they're developing a mood or anxiety disorder secondary potentially to being ostracized or having being bullied or whatever it may be, then I think it's very important to point it out. But, you know, we believe that individual self-advocacy is important, and you don't want to force someone to do anything and make adult decisions as they see fit. But, you know, I think you have to look at what can a diagnosis do treatment-wise, framing things, and if there's a potential benefit, I think bringing it up is appropriate.
See if we can get a couple more calls in here before our time is up. Jeff is calling from Sharonville. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Was just curious as to if you would be able to point to resources for young adults in the transition 2021-22, particularly when they're high functioning Asperger types, but they don't have the ability necessarily to live on their own. I'm not aware of any sort of a social net or organization or sort of resource that they would potentially be able to find housing, food, and other sorts of help or guidance. And wondered if you might have some thoughts that you could share with us.
Janet?
So a couple of things. One is that as far as the social skills groups are concerned, we do have a social group that meets through the Autism Society of Greater Cincinnati. They meet on Sunday. I think it's twice a month now, and you can contact the local chapter for the Autism Society for more information about that. But the other thing that I would look towards is your DDS, which is Developmental Disability Services, to see if they do have a diagnosis. You can find a service manager through that, a service facilitator, and they would be able to help you.
And let's get one more here. Stephanie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question. I work as a therapist several years ago in a community that had a very, very high rate of methamphetamine users, and I want to say probably 80% of the children that I worked with and diagnosed fell into the autistic spectrum, and I'm wondering if there's any research connecting that.
Nothing specific, but we do know that in utero drug exposure with something such as methamphetamines would bring with it an increased risk of behavioral disorders, developmental delay, and communication deficits, which sort of mirror a lot of what we're talking about with autism. But there haven't been any good published research specific to meth abuse linking it to autism diagnoses.
And Stephanie, we appreciate your call. Janet, again, you have a son with autism. What tips would you give for families who are living with these spectrum disorders?
Well, first of all, early intervention is the key. So I think that's important. I also think it's important to recognize that they are people first. And we always say that it's an individual with autism as opposed to an autistic individual. And I think also the most important, two more important things I think also is to remember that to try to provide as many varied experiences as possible so that they have a lot of background information about community and what is offered to them. And then the other thing is that they're going on their own personal timetable. And so I know that it's hard not to compare one child with another child or one individual with another individual, but it's very important for them to work to their own personal best.
And Craig, I'll give you the final word there on living with ASD.
I think the key is to keep a positive outlook. I mean, we try to be very positive in our treatment approach, and that development does occur, that many gains can be made. And as providers of clinical services and as researchers, our goal is really just to improve outcomes. And I think if you look back even in the last 5 to 10 years, the breakthroughs in treatment and research understanding have been incredible. I think society in this country is invested in autism and improving outcomes, and we're really on the up and up to improve early diagnosis and treatment options.
I've been discussing autism spectrum disorders, or ASDs, with Craig Erickson, a psychiatrist and assistant professor in the UC Department of Pediatrics and Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Janet Side, Family Outreach Associate with the Kelly O'Leary Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Children's. You'll find links to additional information on our website, wvxu.org. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about the proper way to use CPR and an automated external defibrillator to save the life of someone experiencing sudden cardiac arrest. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.